Hey, we're in this conversation called In Your Shoes. And last week, we kind of introduced the idea that when it comes to this brand new command that Jesus gave his disciples and then all of us, it is kind of inextricably linked to empathy, the understanding of others and the sharing of feelings of others. If you think about last week, maybe you weren't here, let me catch you up really quick. Jesus is sitting in the upper room and he gives the disciples a brand new command, not like an additional command. He actually reduces all of the commands down to one. Now, they were kind of used to him doing that a few, you know, weeks earlier. The Pharisees, kind of the guys who really were opposed to Jesus, were always trying to trick him. They came to him and said, "Hey, Jesus, what's the most important commandment? Like, aha, we're going to get you." And Jesus went, "Okay, joke's on you. I'm Jesus. I know the answer to that." And so he takes all 600 plus commands and he reduces them down to two. He says, this is easy. Love God, love your neighbor as yourself. Golden rule. That's it. Love God, the golden rule. That's it. Of course, they walked away a little bit befuddled, you know, because he's Jesus. And so now he's in the upper room and it's the night before he's going to be crucified. So there's a lot of significance in this upper room moment. A lot of interesting, powerful things are happening. He washes the feet of the disciples to kind of show them what servant leadership really looked like. He took some bread and broke it. It's where we get our communion today. He broke bread and he said, "This represents my body that's about to be broken for you." And he took the wine, he passed it around. He said, "This represents the blood of this new covenant that's going to be spilled on your behalf, on behalf of humanity." And then he did this interesting thing. He said, "And I also want to give you a new command." And they looked around and he went, not like a brand new and like a replacement for everything. Like, I've already boiled it down to two. Now we're going to make it just one simple command that I'm going to ask you, if you're one of my followers, to follow. And here's what he said. He said, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another." And the disciples heard this new command and they probably thought, "That seems hard, but we've seen you love people. Okay, Jesus, we can probably do that. Like, we've seen you with the sinners and having pizza and hanging out with them. We can do that. We've seen you with the tax collectors. Instead of scissor kicking them in the throat, you had a conversation with them. We can do that too. Like, when you meet blind people, you don't chastise them for their sin or ask them which of their parents got it wrong. Like, you love them. I don't know that we can heal them, but I mean, we can certainly be more loving the way that you've been. Sure, Jesus, we can follow this." Of course, they had no idea, right? They had no idea how far-reaching this new command was actually going to be, because 12 hours later, Jesus is hanging on a cross, and he's hanging there not because he had to. He was hanging there because he loved you, and he wanted to, out of empathy for you and for those disciples, and even for the Pharisees. He hung there because of what was at stake. He hung there because of his great love for you. And so when he said, "I need you to love one another as I have loved you," 12 hours later, that whole verse took on a completely new meaning and really, really got difficult. In fact, I don't think Jesus was trying to make it easy in the first place. I mean, even if it was before the cross, loving everyone as Jesus has loved them, that's hard enough, right? After the cross, it almost feels impossible. In a way, I don't think Jesus was trying to just make it easy, right? If he was trying to make it easy, he would have said something more like this, like, "A new command I give you, love one another. As they are lovable, so you should love one another." That's in my translation, by the way. Like, if he really wanted to make it easy, that's what he'd have told us to do, because we can kind of get that right. Now, we're not even perfect at that, but we're way better at that. Like, love the people who love you, love the people who are kind of agreeable, love the people who are likable, and then just avoid the people who aren't. Like, love your people, avoid those people. That would make it so much easier. We still would get it wrong from time to time, but for the most part, we could live under that command. But unfortunately, that isn't what he said. And then he hung on a cross and put on display what it really looks like to love the unlovable, to love the people who are opponents, even to love people in a way that are evil to you. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news this morning, and don't shoot the messenger, okay? But this includes those people. When Jesus said to love people the way that you have been loved by him, he was thinking about everyone, including those people. And those people are the worst. They are the worst. Remember last week we introduced who those people are? It's really kind of that group of people who are just nearly impossible to love. Those people, it's that group of people in your life that's just almost impossible, maybe impossible to love. They're all over our roadways. They never use their blinker. They don't know how to use the four-way stops. They're always in the left lane, going under the speed limit. You know these people? Those are the people, and you're supposed to love those people. How is it impossible to do that, you know? Those people who are in the other political party, those people who are in the other generation that just annoys you like crazy. They think they're so cool and young and hip, and they're just annoying. They're those people, right? Now, it's weird that those people think of you as those people too, but that's another message. Maybe it's another race, another gender. Whoever the those people are for you, it's kind of unfortunate that when Jesus said that a new command I give you, love one another, he was including those people in that one another. And what's so hard to love about those other people is that they really just see the world differently, or maybe we would say wrongly. Like they just see it wrong. And we know that they don't do it on purpose. I mean, they were born where they were born. They were raised where they were raised. I mean, it isn't their fault that their family of origin looked the way it did. And they think the way they think, which leads to them behaving the way they behave. But they're just getting it wrong. And it's so hard to love these people. Because you know you can't go back and undo their upbringing. You can't go back and redo all the things they should have learned when they were a kid. You know, you can't take them back and spank them because they were never spanked. And that would have really helped when they were four, right? So now they're just wrong. And they have a worldview that is different, but maybe wrong. For the most part, and this is some good news, I guess, for the most part, when it comes to those people, we're kind of able to avoid having a direct relationship with them. And that's a good thing, because if we had a direct relationship with them, it would be really difficult to follow this command. I mean, luckily, we can, for the most part, keep our people over here and those people somewhere over there where they belong, over there. Now, every once in a while, one of those people infiltrates into where our people are, like we accidentally hire one of them, or I don't know, marry one of them, I don't know, accidentally, or maybe one of them just moves in next door. I mean, that's the worst, right? But for the most part, we can avoid being in relationships with those people because they stay over there in their place with their people. We can stay over here in our place with our people. And we can have relationships with our people. And we don't really care what they do with their people. They can do whatever they want. They're getting it wrong anyway. But as long as they stay over there and we can stay over here, we can avoid this relational problem that we have. And that's important. In fact, it's very helpful to avoid relationships with those people. Because when we have a relationship with those people, it's very frustrating for us. It's stressful for us. In fact, most of our sin is their fault anyway. So if we can keep them over there, life is better for us because there's a relational principle at play because the quality of our life is affected by that. In fact, the quality of our lives is only as good as the quality of our relationships. Maybe you've heard that before. If you're married, you know that's true. Like the quality of your life is really only as good as the quality of your relationships. And so if we were forced to be in a relationship with those people, the quality of our life would dramatically suffer. Like if we were forced to be in relationship with those people, our life would be way worse. Luckily, for the most part, we can keep those people over there and we can keep our people over here. Because when you think about relationships, like relationships, I mean, you don't have a relationship with those people. You have a relationship with a person. Like you have a relationship like a spouse or a girlfriend, a boyfriend, a friend, a coworker, maybe a good neighbor, not of those people neighbor. I mean, a relationship is kind of like two people, right? Relationships require two people. Like it takes two to tango, right? I don't even know what tangoing is, but it takes two people to do it. Same with the relationships. It takes two people to have a relationship, right? And that's good news. Because if we don't really have a relationship with those people, it's almost like a new covenant loophole in a way. You know how you look for tax loopholes? This is like a new covenant Jesus loophole. Because if he really wants us to love one another the way that he has loved us, if we need to do that with the people around us, that's one thing. But if we can keep those people over there, it's kind of like keeping us from having to deal with those people. Maybe we won't even have to live out the new command with those people. I mean, in a way, the new covenant loophole is just that you only have to love one another if you are around one another. So if we can keep ourselves from being around those people, maybe we can live out this new command and Jesus will smile the whole time. But think about this for a second. What if our relationships are broader than we actually think? I mean, because when we think about relationships, we naturally go to the individual people that we're in a relationship with. But what if our relationships are actually way broader? What if even the word relationship is broader than we've thought before? See, here's the reality that when it comes to our relationships, we actually have a relationship with anything that we relate to. We do. We have a relationship with anything we relate to. Let me give you a couple of examples just for my life. For instance, I have a very intimate, deep, emotional relationship with a spicy chicken deluxe sandwich with pepper jack cheese and buffalo and ranch sauce on the side. It's delicious. When it's over, I cry a little every time. I mean, it's a real relationship. I have a relationship with jalapenos right now. They're really good. And in fact, have you noticed, it's kind of like the fad food. Have you noticed that jalapenos are? Like it replaced avocado, praise him, right? Who wants that? And so jalapenos replaced avocado. Avocado tried to replace bacon, but bacon's in like the food fad hall of fame. So nobody's gonna ever replace bacon. Jalapenos, I have a relationship with them. I have a relationship with queso. I actually have a lot of food relationships when I think about it. But you do too, right? Like you have relationships with things. You have a relationship with a car, maybe with a boat, maybe with your car and your boat. You have a relationship with a sofa or a house or a pair of shoes. I don't know. I mean, some of you have a relationship with LeBron James, right? And which means that you have a relationship with Cleveland Cavaliers and then the Miami Heat and then the Cleveland Cavaliers again and then the Los Angeles Lakers. I mean, heaven forbid, sorry. Some of you have a relationship with Michael Jordan because you know he's really way better than LeBron will ever be. So what's the point, LeBron, you know? Some of you have a relationship with a sports team. I have a relationship with the Atlanta Falcons. It's very abusive. It's very one-sided, man, right? It's just a constant letdown relationship, and I keep going back to it. I don't know why, you know? But we all do this. We all have relationships with things, not just with people. And we have relationships that are way broader than with individuals. In fact, just for a second, do me a favor. Turn to somebody beside you and just tell them one thing that you have a relationship with that isn't a person or an individual. Can you do that? Really quick. Turn to somebody and tell them one thing you have a relationship with. Yeah, exactly. Go dogs. That's abusive too. All right, everybody said one thing at least. All right, here we go. So here's what's so fascinating about relationships. Here's the most fascinating thing about relationships. We think that they're just in the context of us and one other person, and they're not. Relationships are so much broader than that, which means all relationships matter and all relationships affect us, which also means that we all have a relationship with those people in our life too. We all are actually in a relationship with those people in our life. And I know we're tempted to say, no, we're not. Those people are over there. I'm not in a relationship with the other political party. I don't have a relationship with that generation. I don't have a relationship with the bad drivers, but you do. Because if you have related to it, you have a relationship with it. And that's a really important, maybe principle of our relationships to think about. Because if it's true, if the quality of our lives is only as good as the quality of our relationships, I bet all relationships count. The good ones and the bad ones. The ones we like and the ones we don't. The relationships with our people and the relationships with those people. It all counts. And it all affects us. In fact, I would say that our relationship with those people may be the most abusive and most destructive relationship in our entire lives. And they don't even know that they're in a relationship with you. Yet your relationship with them is affecting you. It's affecting the quality of your life. And it's destructive to your life. Now, when it kind of comes to your car or queso or whatever, I really don't have a lot of advice today. A counselor probably does. I don't. But this guy, the Apostle Paul, has some incredible advice for all of us around the relational side of those people. because Paul had a lot of opportunity to grow in relationships and learn how to deal with opponents. And in the book of Romans, he wrote specifically about this idea of how empathy and those people and all those things kind of work together for those of us that want to be Jesus followers. In fact, Romans is the longest book, the longest letter at least that we have that Paul wrote in our New Testament. He may have written some longer ones, but we don't know about those. And so the book of Romans is written to the Christians in and around the city of Rome 2,000 years ago in the first century. Paul wrote it from the city of Corinth. He was traveling around and he was raising money from all of the Christians and these other churches where he had planted churches to support these Christians in Jerusalem because they were being persecuted and they were all very, very poor and all going without. So Paul was traveling, raising kind of like a love offering money for these other Christians. And as he was traveling, he heard about some things that were happening in the city of Rome with the Christians, and he thought that it was worth addressing it directly in a letter. So he wrote this letter. And the thing I love about Paul in this topic is that if anybody is a subject matter expert, it's Paul. I mean, Paul was up to his eyeballs with those people. I mean, it started in one direction and ended in another. I mean, originally, Paul, his other name, first name was Saul. He was a Christian mercenary. Like, he spent time traveling around as a Pharisee, arresting and executing, murdering Christians, trying to stamp out Christianity until he met Jesus. And it changed everything in his life. In fact, he went from being a mercenary to a missionary. He started traveling around and went on three really long journeys, planting churches and supporting Christians all over kind of the Mediterranean rim. And so as he's in Corinth in one of these cities and one of these churches, he's writing to these Christians in Rome. And here's what he tells them with incredible authority, knowing that he has faced lots of opposition and he has so many people in the those people category, all looking to arrest him, beat him, and eventually they do and they execute him. Here's what he tells those Christians to do, and probably us too. He says, rejoice with those who rejoice, all people, by the way, not just your people, but rejoice with everyone who rejoices, and in the same way, mourn with those who mourn. So when those people are mourning, don't be happy about it. You should mourn with them. Seems kind of odd. He says, live in harmony. Live in harmony with one another. He's starting to quote some of the things he had heard from the life of Jesus. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited, he says. Do not repay anyone evil for evil, which means don't be vengeful. So when those people do something directly in opposition to you, you don't repay them for that. He says, be careful to do what is right in the eyes of not just your people, but all people, everyone. And then he kind of concludes it with this piece of advice. He says, live at peace with everyone. Live at peace with everyone. Now, if you're paying attention, like when you see that, you start to check out a little bit. I would. I mean, think about it. Live at peace with everyone? That's not even possible. That is ridiculous advice. Paul wasn't even living up to that. I mean, live at peace with everyone. If you're a Christian and you read that, you should consider leaving Christianity because that is ridiculous. Nobody can follow that. If you're not a Christian, this is why you don't want to be one. Because you see things like that and you're like, what's the point? Why do I want to be a Christian? I know Christians, they're not even doing that well. What's the point, you know? Live at peace with everyone. It's like, this is what we would expect a pastor or a missionary to say. Here's the good news though. That's the end of the statement. He gave us a little bit more instruction on the front of the statement that is incredibly, incredibly helpful, especially when it comes to those people in our life. Here's how he starts the sentence. He says, if it is possible, to which we all should say, woohoo, because we know it isn't always possible. If it is possible, meaning, if it's possible, there's an acknowledgement. I mean, Paul is not stupid. Paul knows it isn't always going to be possible to live at peace with everyone. Sometimes those people are going to be so difficult, there will never be peace. Sometimes those people are going to behave in ways that are going to be so destructive for them and for you, there is no way there's ever going to be full peace. If it is possible, but not meaning if you can control and change them to make it possible, because you can't control those people. You can only control yourself, right? So if it is possible, and here's the little middle sentence that just gives us the full instruction. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. As far as it is possible, it's not always going to be possible. As far as it is possible, as far as it depends on you, not them, not those people, but as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Basically saying to do whatever you can do. In fact, you could almost summarize Paul's whole thought around this by saying this, that do what you can do as far as it depends on you. Like I know you can't control everything about those people. I know you can't control the way they think and behave. You can't go back and give them a better worldview. Like you can't change any of that. But as far as it depends on you, do what you can do. Do what you can do as far as it depends on you, which kind of begs the question, practically, what really depends on us? Like, what depends on you? If we start to take this idea, this kind of reframing of that new covenant, this is Paul's words for it. If we take Paul's instruction around Jesus's command, how do we apply that in this relational context with those people? How do we actually do that? We know we can't control them. We've tried that before, right? Like, when it comes to those people, they are out of control. There's no controlling them. But what depends on you? Well, what can you control? Like, what are the things that you can do in this relationship? And it may not change them. It may not cause them to think differently, behave differently. I mean, they may think and behave worse. I don't know. But what can you control? As far as it depends on you, what can you do? I started thinking about this, and I came up with four things in my life personally that I know have been obstacles between me and those people, or maybe have been kind of hazards or have tripped me up along the way as I've tried to live out that new command that Jesus gave me, like he gave you. And I have those people too. And they're not always easy to deal with. In fact, sometimes they're opposed to me. And so I started thinking, like, what can I do as far as it depends on me? Like, as far as it depends on me, what's in my control? And I came up with four things, and these four may be your four, or maybe you have seven or 50, I don't know, or maybe there's just one of these that applies to you. Let me show what the four things are that depend on us. For me, at least, I think that our own ego, our pride, our desires, and our prejudices, those things should never get in the way of us living peaceably with others. But they all do. But those things are what gets in the way for me. I suspect it probably gets in the way for all of us. When we want to live peaceably, we want to follow that new command, we want to kind of as far as it depends on us, but those four things can really be difficult for us. Like, for instance, our ego. Our ego should never get in the way of us living peaceably with others. But the problem is that we all have an ego. And our kind of desire for self-esteem or maybe self-importance, Paul talks a little bit about that. It causes us to look down on those people. It causes us to think that we are better than those people. We stop thinking that there's a difference between us, and we start thinking that we're right and they're wrong and that they're worse than us. In fact, our ego begins to cause us to live in a very self-centered way and to surround ourselves more and more and more with our people. So our ego can trip us up when it comes to trying to live out this New Testament ethic that Jesus gave us. And in the same way, our desires can do that. Our pride can absolutely get in the way when we're trying to live peaceably with others. You know, our pride is so difficult to tame. When you think about your relationship with those people and how your pride influences, it really is an obstacle. Like, your pride is what causes you to be unwilling to even want to understand. Your pride is what keeps you from wanting to forgive those people. Your pride is what keeps you from wanting to bend in their direction, even like a little bit. It's our pride that keeps us from ever being able to say that we're sorry or to even admit that we may be wrong. But humility is what does that. Humility is what allows us to lean in the direction of somebody who we don't really understand. Humility works against pride. It's what allows us to forgive or to even seek to understand so that we can begin to figure out if there's a path towards peace. And we can't control how they receive the humility, but we can control our pride, at least as far as it depends on us. The next one is our desires. Like, we really can't let our desires get in the way of living peaceably with others either. I don't know about you, but my desire is to control those people. I want to help them understand better. I want to help them behave better. I want to help them think better. I want to shape their worldview because obviously it's wrong. If they could fix that, it would fix a lot of my problems that I have with them. My desire isn't to understand. Often my desire is to fix. My desire is to control, maybe even manipulate at times. But when we begin to live out of controlling those people or trying to manipulate those people, what we end up doing is building a bigger barrier between us and those people. And we still have a relationship with them, but it's just destructive, mostly for us. And here's the last one. The last one is our prejudices. We should never allow our own prejudices to get in the way of living peaceably with others. Now, before you start composing your email or having a conversation with me to yourself, let me talk about this for a minute, because this is a kind of a scary word, but it's a very important word for us. And I think this is probably true of most, maybe all of us. This is true of me. I have prejudices, but they're not intentional. Like, I'm not walking around intentionally prejudiced against people, but I grew up in an environment like you did. And my environment that I grew up in accidentally taught me some things, and I accidentally learned some things. And like all of us, I am continuing to fight against some of that, but I'm also accidentally tempted to live out of some of that. And it's never intentional. Like, we don't grow up intentionally having prejudice. Most of us don't. Maybe all of us in here don't. But it doesn't mean that we don't have them. And you know what prejudice is, right? I mean, prejudice is kind of making your mind up beforehand without all the information about a group of people. That's all it is, which means that we all have those things. And it's really difficult. It's really difficult to move in the direction of those people if there is a prejudice between you and those people. If I can, just for a moment, I think most of us will understand this. Like, instead of working against our prejudices, most of the time we accidentally fuel those prejudices. And the reason is because we just don't know what we don't know. Like, if we don't recognize that we have a version of prejudice, we don't know that we should be working to rid ourselves of it. And so what we do is we surround ourselves with our people. We keep those people over there, our people over here, which, by the way, oftentimes our people have the same prejudice that we have. And it's unknown. It's not intentional, but they think the way we think. And then here's what we do. Without knowingly doing it, we accidentally fuel it. We surround ourselves with people who fuel it. We consume media day after day after day that's preaching to the choir. It's telling us all the things that we already think are true. And we might be right about that, or we might be wrong about it. But when we consume ourselves with the prejudice that we already have, even if it's accidental, it doesn't cause us to rethink it. It causes it to grow. And pretty soon the prejudice is really powerful. And those people seem even worse than they did before. You see how that works? Prejudice can be a real problem when it comes to our relationship with those people. Luckily, there's a solution to all of these things. And we introduced the solution last week. The solution is empathy. Empathy is understanding and sharing in the feelings of other people. Like, it goes way further than sympathy. Like, sympathy is feeling for somebody, but empathy is actually feeling with somebody. And when it comes to those four things, empathy destroys them all. Empathy actually evolves our ego. It proves our pride. Empathy discloses our desires, and it professes all of our prejudices. Empathy is so powerful. Empathy helps us move beyond us. It helps us understand others, and it changes us in the process. It changes our ego. It changes our self-importance. Empathy proves, it points out the areas of our life where we're unwilling to move or unwilling to bend, unwilling to understand, unwilling to admit that we might not be right. Empathy discloses, it illuminates that internal motivation to control or to manipulate. And empathy always professes those prejudices. Maybe the most beautiful thing about empathy in our life is that it helps us understand what those hidden accidental prejudices even are. Because without empathy, we may never even know they're there. But as we seek to understand and share in the feelings of others, it really makes it clear. And the way it does it is through curiosity. I mean, ultimately, that's where empathy begins. Empathy is always curious. It's never critical. Empathy is always asking questions. It's always seeking to understand. So instead of being critical of those people, empathy wants to engage in understanding those people. Instead of assuming that they're wrong, empathy wonders if you are actually right. But it does it in the relationship through curiosity. In fact, that made me the coolest thing about empathy. Because as the more curious we become, the less critical we automatically are. And the more curious we become, the better questions we start asking. If you think about maybe those people in your life, what would it look like to approach them with kind of an air of curiosity, not criticism? Like, what if you started asking some really, really good questions to those people? I mean, things like, what is it like to be you? Like, what is it actually like to be you? I know what it's like to be me. Like, I know what it's like to walk in my shoes. I know what it's like to be kind of a, you know, 45-year-old white male pastor. I got that part down. But what does it look like to not be me? Like, what does it look like to be you? What an incredible empathetic question to start asking of people. And kind of in tandem with that, what is it like to, what do you think it's like to be me? Like, what is it like to be you? And what do you think it's like to be me? Because everybody on the other side of you thinks they know what it's like to be you too. But when you can start helping them understand that, there's kind of an empathetic sharing that happens. Maybe my favorite question, Jeff Henderson, he's the lead pastor of our Gwinnett locations. He asked this several years ago. When he first asked it, I hated it, and I almost defriended him. He's one of my best friends. I almost just walked away because this question was so painful. And the question is, what is it like to be on the other side of me? What is it like to be on the other side of me? Isn't it true that we're always like so gracious to ourselves and so critical of others? But what would happen if you started asking those people, what is it like to be on the other side of me? Those three questions. What is it like to be you? What do you think it's like to be me? What is it like on the other side of me? Those are some of the most empathetic moments you'll ever have. And it might not change the other person. It might not change those people. But you know what it will do? It will absolutely change you. It will evolve your heart. It will help you understand your pride. It'll show you where your desires to control are. And it'll point out those hidden prejudices that are working against your ability to live out that new command. So maybe the best way to kind of conclude the idea is to go back and look exactly at what Paul said. In fact, Paul's instruction to all of us as Jesus followers is just his restatement of Jesus's new command. So if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. That's what empathy does. And that's what Jesus followers are actually called to do too. Not just with our people, but with all people. Can I pray for us before we leave? Heavenly Father, it seems weird to thank you for those people, but I think we're supposed to be thankful for those people because really we're those people to you in a lot of ways. And you didn't choose to kind of ignore us. You chose to show just the most beautiful moment of empathy the world has ever seen by sending your son and allowing him to die on a cross for us. Even when we were unlovable and when we were running away and when we were kind of spitting on him and hurling insults at him, and he could have come down at any point, but he chose to stay there out of love, even though he wasn't being loved back. So God, I just pray that maybe we can take some lessons from that, from his life, from Paul's life. And as far as it depends on us, be curious and not critical. As far as it depends on us, lean in to understand where other people are coming from. And it may not change them, but God, if it changes us, that might be the point. So God, thank you for that opportunity, even though it's difficult. Give us wisdom to know what to do, and then maybe more, give us courage to actually do it. God, we love you. Jesus, we pray this in your name. Amen.